Good evening, everybody. Welcome to session four of the Night of Ideas. Tonight's session is on open and world cities, with a particular focus on Paris and London. To discuss this panel, we are very privileged to have four wonderful speakers. First, Professor Richard Sennett, who is a truly interdisciplinary scholar and has been described as the greatest contemporary thinker of the city. He has a wide range of activities. He's a fluent French speaker, first of all, and he's a professor of sociology here at LSE. He's chair of the advisory committee of LSE Cities program, former advisor to UN Habitat, and director of Theatre Mundi, which asks the question about what makes urban cultures. And he's going to be discussing the concept of his book, Open Cities. David Mangin is an architect who has undertaken many projects across cities in France, most notably the renovation project in Léal, Châtelet-Léal, which is in downtown Paris. David has written several books, most notably of which, La Ville Franchisée, the franchised city.
It's difficult to translate.
Concerning globalization and the importance of the car in city planning. And tonight, part of what he's going to speak about is new migrations of people to the cities of London and Paris, or rather Paris, and urban developments thereupon. Barbara Lipiet is an interdisciplinary planner with a background in history and development studies. She's lecturer of development planning at UCL and co-editor of the journal City. She's contributed to a number of planning initiatives worldwide, and has a strong global north-south comparative outlook. And she has a particular research interest in modes of participation in the planning process. Martine Droz is a social geographer. She is CNRS, which is the French National Research Council, at LATS, on urban infrastructure and regional planning. She teaches at École Nationale des Ponts et Chaussées and École d'Urbanisme. These are French schools. She has a focus on urban regeneration and impact on local communities. And she's particularly interested in regulatory frameworks and the ways in which the private sector shapes urban space. My name is Samuel Everett. I'm a researcher of anthropology at Cambridge University, and I work in Barbès, which is to the north of Paris, on interreligious encounter within variegated urban spaces. So, without further ado, we'll go to Richard. The order will be Richard, David, and we decided Martine and then Barbara. Your allotted time slot. Thank you, Richard.
Well, first of all, let me welcome those of you to the LSE who are strangers to this, to our school. I want to talk to you briefly about this open city concept. If you were in London 6 weeks ago, you would have perhaps seen the mayor of London and me issuing a kind of appeal for London to become an open city. For the mayor, the notion is that after Brexit, that London will be open to Europe. It's a fundamental conflict that the mayor thinks that he will have after the Brexit negotiations are complete, that the rest of Britain will turn inward, and London, to thrive, needs to turn outward, no matter what national politicians say. So for him, it's a kind of conflict, if you like, between city and nation about the issue of being open. My view of an open city is complementary to that, but it's focused on how to open up the city internally. And it is derived from the fact that our cities are becoming more and more closed in the sense that they're becoming, the territories in them are becoming homogenized economically, ethnically, and racially, and that the functions of the city are becoming more similarly specialized and separated from each other. It's particularly striking, for instance, if you go to the very center of London, Trafalgar Square, which is an empty zone for most Londoners, inhabited only by tourists. And that story is repeated everywhere in the city. The city, in a way, is succumbing to a terrible division of labor and people. And the research that I'm doing is on ways of opening it up internally so that the division of labor and the division of people is weakened, is loosened. I could talk to you all night about this, but since I only have 6 minutes more, I'll tell you the three key concepts that I am working with in this regard. First of all is a concept about the need for animating the edges between communities. We have tended in urban planning to focus on the center of communities, the spaces that where people who, traditionally in cities, where people, different sorts of people mixed together. That focus on the center of the city has meant that the edges between different kinds of communities are less active. Now, given the fact that we have a more homogenized city in these particular zones, racially or economically, it becomes more important to think, instead of the center, to think about the edge and to think about how we get porosity in the edges between different urban places. This is a simple idea with a very, very difficult consequence, which is the notion of places having identities, definable identities, images of place, should be, for us, I think, less important than finding zones of ambiguity, of exchange, where people can't really place themselves. So the notion of porosity at the edge is one part of the open city concept. A second part of it is to take down, and this is in the domain of planning, the notion of complete projects in the city. What capitalism is doing to most cities around the world is installing a regime of self-sufficient projects which are complete in their form and in their purpose the moment that they start to operate. We don't have incomplete forms in the planning of cities, which allows the city to grow and to change its character and structure as the history of the city evolves. For those of you who are French, you will know this in the contrast between those Haussmannian spaces, which are so plastic and flexible and incomplete in that sense. And the kinds of building today in Paris in which the structures are themselves can serve only one purpose, can service only history at one point in time. It's the same story for us here in London with the tower developments that we're building. So the second part of an open city project is how can we give back to the city its incomplete form, spatialized form? How can we build cities that have a kind of historicity and historical flexibility over time as the cities change? The third aspect of it, and we'll talk about this a little later, is the open city concept, very much as you could probably guess from what I've said before, emphasizes the informal character of urban relationships rather than their formal character. It attempts to literally do this by breaking the tight bond between form and function, but socially it attempts to do this by encouraging forms of interaction in the city which are non-programmed. And that's very difficult for planners to take on. We put ourselves out of business by saying, we have no program here, just use the space, make of it what you will. It's a recipe for early retirement for somebody my age. But it's, I think, of the three, this is the most important. For one reason, that informal social relations tend to be visceral rather than verbal. They tend to be people associating with each other in the same space without having to clarify their relations with one another. This is a classic source of vitality in the city, that you are with people whom you are not necessarily known to or who know you. In other words, informality and the space of the stranger, of anonymity, go together. Anyhow, this is what I mean by an open city. And I think if we can make more planning, large cities like Paris and London, follow these precepts, that we will have a city which is both more robust in terms of its patterns of growth, but also more just in terms of questions of inclusion and sociability in the city. So that's what I mean by an open city.
Thank you very much indeed, Professor Sonnet. If you'd like to take the microphone, David.
Works. Okay. Good evening. Thank you for the introduction, Richard. I tried to give some pragmatic ideas from this concept from my point of view, which is a town planner and an architect. So I'm really worry about some of the questions and mostly the first one you express and the third one I would say, which is how to do that. First, having charged to speak a little bit about Paris. When we speak about Paris, what are we speaking of? Are we speaking of the inner city, 2.5 million inhabitants, the first crown, it's about 4 million inhabitants, or the third crowns, which is about 5 million inhabitants. What is very important for us since about 10 years is that everybody understood that Paris, it's called a metropolis in the political jargon. In fact, it's a megapolis of 12 million inhabitants, and it works like a megapolis in a developed country. But in three speeds, very different. Three social speeds, three physical speeds. The inner center, 50% have no cars. And in the third crown, everybody is working with a car every day, with two cars every day. So it makes very different cities. And we have to, what happens in Paris, if I want to share with you, is that we try, since the Sarkozy consultation in 2008 with several people from different disciplines, we try to think about how works a megapolis and how the problems and the contradiction of the political policies in a different way. So what is the main project at the moment is to make a ring mass rapid transit of an automatic metro with 64 stations all around Paris. Why? Because we have a very good system of a radio concentric city, but a lot of people work, in fact, from periphery to periphery, and they have to use their car, or if not, they have to get back to Les Halles. So I know quite well the problem of Les Halles. You have 800,000 people every day coming through Les Halles, and then they go. So a young guy coming from a housing estate from in the north of Paris, if he wants to work in the platform or Roissy, he has to get back to Gare du Nord or to Les Halles and then get here. So this is a real problem. But if I want to illustrate also those kind of contradiction, if we do this ring road, we are also making a development of the sprawl system. And on one way, we try to make a more intense city and not a sprawling city. And in another way, because now you can get to... In a few years, you will go to the stations, and you can have it farther on and farther on. And so this is one example of the problems. So if I start to understand to answer or to dialogue with the points that Richard put on the discussion. The first about the porosity of the edges. What is very difficult is that the modern city have been made by the car for the car. It's not anymore the blocks, which mainly made the ordinary city. I'm not speaking of the innocent historical center, but where most of the people live. They live in sector with high speed or more or less high speed car system, and on this it's plugged not only gated communities and residential communities, but all the programs in fact works like this, with one entrance. It's for business, for tourists, for all the programs, for shopping malls, of course. They work all like this, plug from so. To make move this system is going to be very difficult, because we inherit this system, and we are, despite all the discourse about sustainable development and more transportation, we can't follow as quick as this system is going through. So this is the one of the main problems. About the informal, I think the question of the migrants is very interesting and is an opportunity to make a more flexible and more open city, despite the policy of some government. Why? Because if we want that the migrants, which are going to stay, despite the in France, they think it's transit population, but in fact they want to stay. So if we want to make a more welcome city, we have a lot to understood from the informal city of the South American cities, of the African cities, where the informal was is the real city. In fact, is the majority of the city. And in my everyday work, it's very difficult to make flexible program, pragmatic program, to make some part of the building in a self-built construction later on, to make short rent, so the people can. So for instance, to make a ground floor of the city in the streets. So the conditions of the living streets, it's very difficult because the developer doesn't want a flexible system. They make an urbanisme de produit, a product town planning, right, not a project urbanisme. So I think this is a good fight to make move these things in relationship with, because everybody wants that. We want a more flexible things. For instance, the question of housing, for instance. Instead of making big program of housing estate that we can afford, if you let the people in the pavilion system that you can see as a very huge allotments in the large suburb of Paris, the mayor didn't let, because of the nimby positions of a lot of electors, they don't let make some extensions of the housing or renovation of the housing. And in fact, this is the way that the city must develop, and they always develop like this. And we're in a period since about some decades that it's all fixed. So, especially in France, the house is put in the middle of a garden, much far from the neighbor, and after all the rules of town planning, they can't move the house. But now, what is interesting? It's because of the economic crisis. Yes, I'm just going to finish. There is a demand for housing. When the mayor himself can't make some house for his kids, he tried to understand that it's good things to make a division of the lots and make housing. So, just to finish, I mean, you have the ideas and you have the economic system. And at one point, sometimes the things are going together and the idea find economic models and they try to chat, to be optimistic. I think this is my experience.
Thank you very much, David Langin. We'll pass quickly over to Martine, please.
Thank you. Good evening. So I'm happy to take the opportunity of tonight's panel and discussion to reflect on the tension inherent to the notion of openness applied to contemporary cities and their design. Look at the notion of openness and open cities by focusing on urban public space, physical and immaterial, and the extent to which urban design and policies can allow for diversity of uses and political situation in public space. By many aspects, as it was noted, global cities such as London and Paris have become more open. They are more open and they are more international as well. And at the same time, cities are confronted with the challenge to remain open to their citizens, not only to investment, to activities that they attract from different parts of the world. They're confronted with this challenge to remain open and to respond to the sometimes conflicting needs coming from the various communities who inhabit them. In this context, urban planners have to respond to an increasingly complex socio-demographic situation in order to create the very possibilities for democratic experiments and experiences through the built environment. However, as you noted in a previous talk, the technologies, including planning and urban design, which make possible experiment, have been subordinated to a regime of power which wants order and control. Quoting the example of the Corbusier Pont Voisin, designed for Paris in the 20s, he noted how this vision destroyed the ground plane, which is the physical element that actually creates openness in the city, which is the very concrete possibility for indetermination and unexpected encounters, which are two situations, two features that are, as many political thinkers would argue, the basis for democracy. It seems that current Paris is far from the Corbusier dystopian dream. The qualities of central public spaces have indeed been rediscovered recently, having been the scene for new social movements and democratic experiments. One square, one particular place in Paris, the Place de la République, the Republic Square, has become the symbol of this rediscovery, let's say. So this square is located at the center of the capital. It was recently reorganized by the planning team of the mayor of Paris with a design, as expressed by planners, that did not determine any particular use. Planners, in the reconfiguration of, in the redesign of this place, they have adopted a non-plan approach. With a success that was larger than expected, it became an open public space that was the main site for open tributes and civic gatherings following the attacks in November 2015. And it also became the locus of the civic movement Nuit Debout, a series of occupations contesting the deregulation of the French labour market. These events were celebrated by, among others, the French philosopher Jacques Rancière. As Rancière said, the occupation of the square appears as an illustration of a peculiar feeling that we could identify as a desire for community. With other occupations movements in Athens, in London, in Madrid, in Istanbul, this movement shares a common concern to return to a form of politics that is effective in subverting materially a given order of spaces and time. Of course, open political spaces are not only made possible by the availability of a public square. They also require the democratic qualities of public debates and, as Bruno Latour famously said about democracy, the possibility to disagree. London and Paris display various levels of openness, of democratic openness, and allow different places for disagreement and collective discussion while remaining, more often than not, unchallenged in their assumptions, particularly with regards to urban development. Despite an increase in participation and participatory democracy in the form of wider public debate, numerous voices are denouncing the urban exclusion that affects a growing proportion of people in Greater London and in Greater Paris. Especially in London, a cursory look at the evolutions of the urban landscape, or what was called the inner city, suggests the amount of pressure that is felt by the population and the speed at which with the London of the elite has grown out of its historical boundaries. In Paris, many colleagues working on large-scale urban development projects, especially in the north of Paris, have noticed that these have increased the pressure put on the most vulnerable population and created new drivers or new spaces of exclusion. In a context where planning has become more participatory, how come the participative procedures and debates do not slow down or limit the rate at which the metropolis is upgraded into a real estate developer view of heaven? What can be done to regulate the extraction of rent that is pushing the already worse off further away from the centre, creating some prophylactic barrier to the actual existing diversity? In my views, and others as well, especially my colleagues from the urban economic centres in Paris where I work, the situation is rooted in the strategic role of funding and finance in the regeneration schemes. It's a crucial aspect to understand the rise of both open and exclusive cities. My colleagues, Antoine Guironet and Ludovic Albert, have used the term, the expression yield urbanism, to describe the growing role of contemporary financial reasoning and high profit expectations at every stage of urban production, from strategic planning to delivery and maintenance, and how it creates new forms of social and spatial fragmentation which reduce the possibilities for opening and democratic experiments. In London, the continued participations of civic society groups that Barbara will present and their involvement in different public debate, in the examination in public, for instance, of the London plan, shows that it is possible to actually reclaim open and potentially undeterminate arenas for democratic discussion. In the same way, civic movements reclaim open, undeterminate Republic Square in Paris. We can believe in the power, or I do actually believe in the power of civic society, to limit the extension of what we could call, following the French philosopher Jacques Bouvresse, the territory of cynicism, which is where the democratic potential of urban design is actually limited to a few. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Martine.
yes to lack of cynicism. So I want to thank you for being here, inviting me, the organizers, and also apologies for my voice. It's the season of cold, and I've been caught. So I'd like to echo my colleagues' aspirations for cities as open and well cities, laboratories of innovations and democracy, civic engagement. And I'm taking a slightly different take here. In the current political global context, I think cities' potential to become sanctuary of such values of openness and of inclusion of democracies are becoming all the more pressing and all the more precious, and I really don't think that we can take them for granted. So what I'd like to concentrate here is not so much about the built environment dimensions of openness, the way in which the built form, the materiality of the city can facilitate transformative approaches and inclusion. My colleagues have done so very eloquently. Instead, I think I'd like to steer the conversation towards the ways we can help cities resist, open up, remain, or become worldly. And by worldly, I don't mean in the academic jargon of the term, which tends to be very competitively driven, world cities and global cities, but very much the kind of world cities and open cities that Richard and others have been discussing. And I like very much here to think of Leonie Sandercock and her call for the multicultural city. So how then can we help cities become these kinds or remain these kinds of multicultural cities? Because help they will need. Not all cities are able or will be able to withstand the waves of nationalism and closure that we're witnessing at national levels here in the UK and, of course, across the world, in many parts of the world, both in the global north and global south. And after all, cities are inserted in their national socioeconomic and institutional political fabrics in very different configuration, which does open and close their possibility and their room for maneuver for being these kinds of open worldly cities. So I find particularly interesting in this instance to monitor and see the way in which London will be able to resist the closing exclusionary effects of Brexit versus, for instance, Los Angeles or Boston's sanctuary city status in the context of Trump's clampdown. My hunch is that actually the federal systems and local dependency, which have at certain points contributed to the entrepreneurial drive of these cities, might in this particular political context act in favor of cities' ability to remain autonomous and their ability possibly to resist exclusionary tendencies. But I'd be very happy to hear what you think about that. Let's be hopeful. Let's discuss. So tonight I would just really like to call for a protection, indeed a boost to cities' openness and worldliness through the activation of networks and alliance building at multiple scale. And I'm going to talk about two scales in particular, or rather two entry points for thinking about this alliance building. The first is very much at the level of cities, progressive cities, building and reinforcing alliances to support each other, to advocate together. And I'm able to call upon that because there's already some fantastic and very encouraging experiences of such processes of alliance building going on across the world. I refer here to cities' collective pledge to uphold the Paris Agreement in the face of Trump's threatened review of COP21. And there's a number of organizations and networks here, CAC 40 Cities, UCLG, Global Covenant for Mayors, etc. Also, the counter summit of cities and regional leaders that made their stand, their own declarations, and their own pledges in Bogota a week before national states convened in Quito to decide on the new urban agenda. And in that instant also, I think it's very crucial to note that cities, through their networks and through UCLG in particular, were very active proponents of the alliance that managed to ensure that the right to the city, however diluted, does feature in the new urban agenda. Now, the latter example, the presence of the right to the city in the new urban agenda, is very telling because it talks of progressive policies and pledges that were for cities, that were developed through networks of cities, but in alliance with networked community groups, NGOs, and social movement. So in particular, the main conduit, the main pressure point for getting the right to the city in the new urban agenda was the global platform of on the right to the city, which includes HIC, Habitat International Coalition, ACHI, Asian Coalition of Housing Rights, the SDI Network, WeGo, Huawei Commission, and, of course, cities in the form of UCLG. So the scale of co-construction of open or world cities here is very much international, but I'd like to come back to this local local dimension as well, which brings us back to the issue of democratic potentials of cities that has been invoked by Martin and Richard in different ways. So despite the clampdowns, despite the financializations of cities, despite the closures, there remain some impressive innovations in participatory local governance out there that point to really concrete reifications of the possibilities of participatory making of cities. Can cite here examples of participatory budgeting, example of participatory processes in informal settlement upgrading, even examples of cities, and I'm talking here of local authorities, supporting bottom-up processes of inner-city regeneration, inclusive form of placemaking and production of space. But because we're in London, I'd like to draw attention to the current process of participatory governance at scale, which is currently taking place through the current remaking of the London Plan, which is this long-term strategic vision for the city at the metropolitan scale. It's a noteworthy example, not only because we're here, but because participatory long-term strategic planning at the metropolitan scale is notoriously difficult to do. Strategic planning is difficult to do, but in a participatory way, it's particularly difficult to do. And while some cities have been experimenting, London has been experimenting with this for the last, 10 years. No, it's almost 15 years now, I think. But under the current mayor, there's a sort of a deepening of that process with the mayor launching in his election manifesto, saying that to achieve a fairer, more equal city, we need to enable all Londoners to actively participate in the life of the city and the decisions that affect them. And in the process, there's been a whole series of consultations that have been that have been more than just tick boxing exercises. There's been a number of workshops, a number of focus groups that have been open. So this is all in the making. The first draft of the plan will actually only come out in the autumn, and there's an ongoing process of engagement with community groups. But what I want to finish with really is that this example is particularly striking, not only because of the openness of the new local government to engaging with community groups, but that there's an extraordinary response that is taking place with very committed community group networks that are actually really seizing this opportunity to engage and to co-produce the city. And I'm thinking here of networks such as Just Space, Reclaim Our Spaces Network, activists from Take Back the City, who are coming up, who are pressurizing, who are entering the cracks that are being opened up by local authority here to really try and make real the notion of co-creating our cities, our open cities. And it's not an easy process, and there's many hitches along the way already, and there will be no doubt many more. But if London is really to become a world city in the sense that we talked about, a world city that is able to withstand the tide of financialization and really become this carnival of the multicultural cities, it's going to have to take these kind of alliances and network building much more seriously.
Thank you very much. we have 15 minutes left for a little bit of debate. And perhaps a question or two. It's going to be tight. One of the key questions that you've all been discussing has to do with participation at the planning process from bottom up. You've also been discussing more top-down processes, and the beginnings of a conversation was emerging between the both of you around the question of new forms of migration and how they interact in the city. And I was wondering how you reconcile the kind of plasticity that you were discussing with new forms of itinerant and non-itinerant migration to these megalopolises, Paris and London, with the participatory side of planning. Is there? It sounds like a tall order.
Just to for the discussion, I think the discussion about co-creating, participation, and so on must not escape a few points of view. Not to be cynical, saying the market will solve the problem. Not to be romantic, favela is a great place to and picturesque place to live. And not to be angelic about this. From our experience, sometimes I made some project with the people. I say the people, the elected people, and the representation of the neighborhood or different stages, following some cities or some political guys. It depends. And sometimes I made it with. Sometimes I made it against, and sometimes I have the feeling I made it for. For instance, if I take Les Halles, you have a station. So you have, as I said, 100,000 people, and the room, the interchange room, is in very bad state. So everybody, if you ask the people, what do you want to do? I mean, they are just crossing. I want to get back to my place. So you can make inquiries, but everybody knows that. Well, if you look to the some programs. You can have a discussion about the programs, but it has a scale of Paris, and even the suburbs of Paris, because they are using very big equipment. But if you go to the public spaces, now the problems are started, because people are using, and they want exactly the same that they have. And if you want to say, we want to make something larger for more people, because everything is going to be enlarged, and then the problem started, because it's not so easy. People just want a kid garden and so on, and you say that perhaps we can discuss two different things. So the things are much more complex, in fact, that the scales are different and the people are different and the situation are very different.
Well, you mentioned the migrant issue, which is very much on our minds. As you know, Britain has taken in very few refugees, to its great shame. And part of that shame is that... I won't go into that. One thing that we have... people in London have been thinking about, which is quite similar to what people in cities in America are thinking about, is... to issue urban passports. Now, this may not get anybody past the barriers at Heathrow exactly, but the problem is how to include people who are productive members of a community, of a city, rather, against a nation state that doesn't want them. And so this urban passport, it's something very much brooded about in America in terms of how to give Mexican, so-called illegal Mexican immigrants, 40% of whom have been in the United States more than 10 years, how to give them some rights. And if I were looking, I'm very much in favor of this, and I'm in favor of it particularly because it calls into question the notion that the nation state is the controller of people's rights rather than the city. As a theorist, it's an interesting proposition. But as a citizen, I think that if we can contrive these urban passports, that we will have at least an instrument of contesting the power of the nation state over the city, and incidentally, giving people who have no rights some claim on citizenship. There is no basis in law for this. The only places that have urban passports are in China. Say no more. This would require a complete rethinking of the notion of the relationship between place and right. But you say you want to be hopeful in some way. To me, this is hopeful at least because it's some way of putting into question the notion that the undocumented, or in this country, the refugee, are somehow not part of the nation. When our prime minister famously said, "To belong everywhere is to belong," I can't remember the quote, I've repressed it, "is to be a citizen of nowhere." It seemed to me that this, not to be a citizen of a nation is not to be a citizen of nowhere. This is a way of at least contesting it. And it is we're actually going to try it in London, issuing these passports, and see what happens. And what will happen is there'll be a lot of conflict, which is good.
Would you like to respond on that bombshell?
Yeah, no, it's an interesting thought, and I'd heard it floating. Can I slightly come back to an earlier point that you had made, Richard, which is this, you know, acknowledging this migrants' right to be in the city and their production of the city and the making of the city. In London in particular, the making of this image of diversity, which is being sort of put forward as being the definition of London and what makes its attractiveness. Very interestingly, in the previous plan, so there was this call and celebration of diversity, but actually all the policies, in particular because of the favoring of developer-led models of development, meant that actually migrants were being kicked out, especially migrant markets, for instance. So I wanted to come back to this notion of immigrants' right to be in the city, not through the notion of passport, but through their acknowledgement in space, in particular space of the city. And just to see how that would work with the openness of space and working at the boundaries that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. I'm very attracted to that idea. I find it very challenging and interesting. And I remember the ways in which, for instance, ABC region outside of São Paulo, the PT was trying to reconnect the favelas to the city by putting services that belong to all, like ATM machines, at the borders, in order to encourage people from the city to come close to the favelas. And that was a really interesting use of space and to create openness and to create encounters. But I'm also a little bit worried that the openness and the working at the borders and not recognizing people's identity to space might work against some that are most vulnerable in a context where cities are, like London, are being homogenized through these, right, you know, buildings that are pushing away markets like Seven Sisters, etc.
Mm. Yes. No, I see that.
So I don't know.
I see the problem with this. I mean, We all have multiple identities in the city. And I think for, at least for the migrant groups that I've worked with, which is more in America than here, the identities that are strongest for people who are marginal are the work identities. The work identities. And it's another aspect of this whole passport notion that if you're employed, you should have the rights because you're employed. But it's also a sense for people who are very marginal that their identity at work is not, it's not really place-based in the same way. When you remark that a lot of these peripheral relations are from periphery to periphery, that's because that's where marginal labor can insert itself in New York City, for instance. The journeys that most non-documented workers take is from periphery to periphery. But the point I want to make about this is that maybe we've put too much importance on the idea of place in terms of where people sleep. Maybe we need to think about place as place in an order of production, of labor. And I think that would give us a different sense of political possibility, like the fact of, I hope, the fact that we will be issuing these urban passports, which are based on not where you live, but on the fact that you are productive and you're paying into a system of benefits and so on. So I would say you raise a real problem, but I think it raises another problem, which is where are people's identities? You know, where are they? Can you answer that?
It's interesting.
I have no answer.
I think there are multiple identities, and people have different attachment to place, and there are different ways in which they relate to place. What was interesting in the work that we developed with the Just Space Network, when we were trying to help them think about the notion of social inclusion in the London plan, because they developed this network of community groups in London did something which is quite remarkable, I think, which was to develop a community-led plan for London. So instead of waiting for the plan to arrive and to say, we're going to respond, they actually were proactive in developing what would be an approach to planning in London, developed by a whole network of community groups. And it's imperfect, and it's something in the making. But something that was really interesting was working with migrant communities, especially, and ethnic migrant traders, as they call them. They developed this idea of irreplaceability when looking at developments and the various kinds of impact assessment that need to be done. In the English planning context, you need to have a number of impact assessment, whether it's health, environmental, social. And they put on the table this notion of irreplaceability. So what happens if a local authority wants to remove this local market which is dominated by migrant traders? It will just simply not be, which is a place of work, but is also a place of identity formation and of belonging. And so can this sort of intangible but absolutely precious notion, can that be brought into the decision-making process in planning? I thought it was a very interesting approach. But, yeah, complicated. Because place is always...
People fight over it.
Can we perhaps take a question or two from the audience, or perhaps one question, given the fact we have 1 minute remaining?
One question with no answer.
You pick.
Thank you very much for those interesting...
You have to speak loudly.
Thank you very much for those interesting insights. I had a question particularly for Marty about what you talked about reclaiming public space, and especially in the context of Place de la République. I had a question about the maybe like pay attention to the like the suburbs or on the periphery, and how the like the particular challenges that, that can pose, because so the idea that could it be more difficult in the context of the suburbs, or and I'm thinking about the dormitory cities, for example, les villes dortoirs, the idea that people don't really live in the suburbs, would it be more difficult to organize politically and to reclaim space in those space in the suburbs, like the particular challenges that would be faced by people living in the suburbs, if that makes sense?
I don't know the extent to which those we should consider the impact of the built environment on the very possibility to have social movements. What happened with the civic gatherings at the Place de la République is that they were highly visible and they had wide recognition, media visibility. And actually similar movements happened in the periphery, across the periphery, and were organized by similar networks, actually, who actually connected from the Place de la République to these areas, but they received, of course, less coverage. So I guess it might be possible that the built environment, or because of the socio-spatial configuration of the periphery, it might be more difficult to organize social movements. But at the same time, there are counterexamples, and there is an extraordinary civic life across the peripheric that can actually be definitely organized and jump the scale and jump the site-specific organization to connect at a metropolitan level, and hopefully the way it connected in London.
I'm afraid that's going to be it. Do you want to wrap up? We have time. I do apologize for those who had questions. We don't have time for any more. So just to say thank you very much to the wonderful panel.